Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, last week we had a passing of Barbara Bush, age 92, the matriarch of the Bush family. There's a lot of reporting on Barbara Bush, the Bush family, and it's interesting to see how the family was reported in the news. We have this storied political family in American history, the Bushes. Obviously, two presidents. We have what he guess his father, George H. W. Bush's father, Prescott Bush, was a senator. Its history, how it started, was I think Samuel Bush, son Prescott Bush, married into the Walker family of St. Louis, a very prominent business family, banking family, had connections to the Harrimans, the Morgans, Rockefellers and these things, so these families. And I believe how the story goes, it was his marriage to Dorothy Walker, George Walker's daughter, which got him a promotion of sorts to go to work for Brown Brothers Harriman, which was, I think, partially founded by Walker, George Walker. And that was sort of his rise. He was the Prescott Bush, the father of George H.W. Bush, was the first, I think, member of Skull and Bones, and so was George W. Bush. I mean, sorry, H.W. Bush. And so that's the Skull and Bones connection. But this is sort of his rise with Brown Brothers Harriman. After World War II, he was able to parlay his success in the business world into a political career, became senator of Connecticut because I believe the sitting senator happened to die. And so he got the nomination, and it was a Connecticut seat that was, you know, loyally Republican, so he became senator. And I believe Prescott Bush was the one that started Richard Nixon's career. He is the one that got him to run for House of Representatives in 1946 against Jerry Voorhees, who reportedly was a thorn in the banker's side. And, of course, he's the one that got him on the ticket with Dwight Eisenhower in 1952, so he became vice president. So it was largely through that that Nixon became a national figure. Of course, the Cold War politics, Nixon and the thing with, you know, what's his name? You know, the old communist. I forget his name. You know, the Alger Hiss. He's the one that
Alger Hiss, absolutely. Sorry,
Alger Hiss. Yeah, Alger Hiss. And so the Bushes are very closely connected to Nixon. That's something that most people don't realize. But that, yeah, but then, you know, George, the son, went off to World War II, worked for Naval Intelligence, which is interesting, reconnaissance, was reportedly shot down. Came back, graduated from Yale, I think, in 1948, I think, somewhere around there. Yeah, Skull and Bones, of course, and went down to Texas to find his fame and fortune in oil. And that's when it gets really murky with some of these various companies like Zapata Oil, a very murky relationship. He never left intelligence. And that's we can talk about that, his connections to some of the more defining moments in post-war history in the United States. So that's the Bush family. That's sort of like a sterilized version of the Bush family. So, really the Bush, the story of the Bush family starts with Brown Brothers Harriman. And that's, again, I mean, that's where Prescott Bush got his fortune. For a better description of the Bush dynasty, I'll just read this and I'll let you kick in here. I was reading the introduction to Roger Stone's book, and the introduction, I believe, is called A Dynasty of Duplicity. And he goes, in only four generations, the Bush family has seen two presidents, one senator, a director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and two governors. They've been involved in and enabled two world wars, countless other wars, the control of oil, the funding of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi movement, drug smuggling on an international scale, and the gutting of America's savings and loans to the tune of billions of dollars. How could they have pulled this off? Why weren't they all in prison? This is their story. This is the story of the Bush family. So, and how this all happens is, apart from Elite Deviance, a book by Professor Robert Simon, how'd the Bush family get away with it? And he says, well, a phenomenon in which those who are with enough wealth, political influence, and personal connections can immunize themselves from the consequences of illegal acts that the rest of the world would bring severe consequences. I believe acts that the rest would be severe consequences, if not life-ending repercussions. The story of the Bush crime family is century long. And a couple quotes here. This is kind of funny. Supposedly by George H.W. Bush, first president of the United States, the source is Sarah McClendon. If the American people had ever known the truth about what we Bushes have done to this nation, we would be chased down the streets and lynched. And here's another quote by George W. Bush, the 43rd president of the United States, to the BBC. This might have been a mistake, but I think his mistaken quote is more honest. Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we. So that's kind of my take of the, or at least that's, I think, the more accurate take of the Bush family, the Bush crime family. So what do you want to say about the Bush family?
Well, first of all, I wanted to go back one, or actually maybe two generations before Prescott. Prescott's dad was Samuel P. Bush, and he was kind of, I think, the beginning of the the political power. It wasn't really Prescott. It was actually Samuel that transitioned. There's something strange about the family and the way that, you know, they have this meteoric rise. Everything they do, just suddenly they're dominating an industry or, you know, becoming senator. But Samuel Bush was born in 1872, and he went to work with Frank Rockefeller, who was John D's brother, and basically he was running the manufacturing and motive power of the railroads.
This was was this Buckeye Steel?
Yeah, okay. Buckeye Steel, exactly. And so Frank Rockefeller owned it, but evidently was also, John D was a silent partner. And so Bush was already, you can see, this is like, 1886 or something. And already there is this pull of power into the Bushes are being brought up. That's where the Bush family connected with the Harrimans. Mm-hmm. Was actually in the relationship that Samuel Bush had with Harriman as one of the customers, because Harriman was buying railroad parts from Buckeye Steel, and so that was where the Bush and Harriman family actually met. Now it gets weird because. Okay, so you can think, well, this is a smart guy. He's making railroads and steel parts. But for some reason, in 1918, Bernard Baruch, he was in charge of the War Industry Board. He basically placed Samuel Bush as the chief of ordnance, small arms and munition, with national responsibility for all, U.S. munition manufacturing. Now, see, this is just too strange that, the guy that, Desert Storm and then, the second Iraq invasion with George W., that the great-grandfather was also a merchant of death, mm-hmm. with national responsibility. So I just think that this is kind of a strong indication, since this is sort of the provenance of the family, that They are, plugged into what I see as a kind of multi-generational operation, right? And death is the, is the trademark. No matter what this family does, they just swirl around warfare. And so I was kind of actually, I hadn't realized this, that I knew that Prescott, what he was, but then to see that even Samuel had actually been in charge of munitions in the United States during World War One. That's just, to me, that's you can see that it's a system that family fits into somehow. We don't understand it, of course, but it surely is the case that these guys are involved in something. And then if you look at Samuel Bush, you can also see that he was another Bush family guy who had connections into secret societies. It's harder to see, but I think that you can. I've been finding quite a bit of connections between them and Freemasonry. So, we'll as we go forward in our little discussion, we can bring out most of these things. But one last fact about Samuel is he was on the Federal Reserve Bank board. So, here you have the just absolutely highest level of malfeasance imaginable, where the Federal Reserve is set up and Samuel Bush is placed on the board. So I think these two facts, that he's placed on the board of the Federal Reserve and that he's charged basically overseeing the munitions of World War One, this is the trademark of the family.
Yeah, you're seeing that union or relationship between oil, natural resources, banking, finance, and government, particularly military and intelligence. And the important point here is that these families are using the military and intelligence bureaucracies to enrich themselves. And they do it by taking it over. And they not only do they profit from it, they control it. So, so there's obviously a direct conflict of interest here. So that's they get into intelligence and these things, and if you look at the whole formation of the intelligence community, particularly CIA, figures like Dulles Brothers, Robert Lovett, they all came from Wall Street and banking, and so they all come from this milieu or community, if you will, who all network with each other, and this is the practical function of outfits like Skull and Bones and supper clubs and these things. So they're all networking with each other. And if you don't like the word conspiracy, that's fine if that bothers you. But if you want to say networking, confluence of interest, if you will, but it's, if you just do check some names and how they're related to one another. And again, that schematic we always talk about, well, there it is. This is indeed a conspiracy, whether or not you want to call it a criminal conspiracy. It's up to whoever is looking at us. But if you think of these things, if you don't think they're fomenting wars and civil wars and causing the death and destruction of tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people and destroying lives of more and robbing humanity blind and the process isn't a crime, well, then I don't know what fits that definition for you. So let's just call it a criminal conspiracy, as it is a crime family, one of the highest levels. Now, of course, the Bushes themselves, they kind of made their money and their fame being kind of managers for these bigger families like the Harrimans and the Rockefellers and ultimately the Rothschilds and perhaps families unknown. So that's kind of their managers working for these folks. And the book I read a couple times, the best kind of book that kind of just describes the role of the Bush family in the military industrial complex, the global war to order, is Russ Baker's book, Family of Secrets: The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. I've actually read it a couple times, and Russ Baker is an interesting journalist because he fancies himself a very serious mainstream journalist who still thinks outfits like the New York Times has some value. Yet he tries to keep one foot in the conspiracy community, one foot in the mainstream media, and I don't think he's been successful in doing that, because I think now he's kind of written off as sort of a gadfly or kind of a conspiracy theorist because of his research. But if you read his book, or actually had the benefit of listening to some of his interviews about this book, there is a 7-hour interview. He does a series of interviews with Dave Emery, which I highly recommend, that really goes into his book and covers these names. And outside of reading the book, that interview is a great interview. It's 7 hours worth of interviews over the course of a couple months, about eight, 9 years ago. He gets into these relationships, and it's, again, it's one of these books that may not go deep enough, because he just points out the political and financial connections and unearths the fact that it really is the hidden history of American history, because Watergate, the Kennedy assassination, these things take a completely different meaning to you if you read that book and you read other people's research in these things, and how the Bush family seems to be at the center of this all, particularly George H.W. Bush. Who, according to the evidence, I think, was a CIA asset in his entire adult life, and then he became president. So that's my 2 cents worth on that. So,
yeah, indeed. And so I going back even another generation, I was going to point out, I thought I would just bring this up, that, you know, these families always have secrecy. You know, they've got to belong to these secret societies. Mm-hmm. There was the guy who ends up Samuel Prescott with control over the munitions, there was James Bush, and he was born in 1825. He went to Yale, and he was one of the founding members of the Wolfhead Society. The Wolfhead Society was the second secret society in Yale. Skull and Bones had, you know, was tapping 15 people, I guess, a year, and it turned out they needed another secret society to contain all the people who needed to have secrets kept. And so the Wolfhead Society was founded in 18, I forget which year it was, but he was in the first group. And so you get this just strange pattern, Tim, you know, of Yale College and then a secret society. And the last, of course, the three Bushes that are current to us are all members of Skull and Bones. And so, you know, when they talk about Bush as a crime family, you know, I don't know. It's hard to find, everything they do is criminal, but at the same time, you know, they don't get caught doing petty acts of crime. You know, the low crime stuff, the stuff that you could be put in prison for, they avoid that. What they are is a criminal family that basically has taken part of the group that's taken control of the whole political system. Mm-hmm. And so that's what, that is the crime. What did you see, like, evidence in Stone's book? Because I couldn't really find, you know, at Bush as a crime family, low crimes. I don't see many of that in this group.
Well, actually, I didn't read Stone's book. I read the intro to it. I thought the intro was, but as far as their crimes, they're definitely high level operators, and so they're not the ones pushing. Although, from what I understand, Jeb Bush at Andover was involved in selling drugs and these things, they're involved in, you know, obviously, when you deal with intelligence, the CIA, outfits like the CIA, will manage the criminal enterprises like the drug trade and work with criminal elements like the mafia when it suits them. What you had, like, in 1960-61, where George H.W. Bush has been connected to, JM Wave or Operation 40 in Cuba, the CIA handling some of the Cubans and these guys. He's involved in the Bay of Pigs, and because he's operating front companies, because when you're doing intelligence work and you're doing it in a way you want to avoid accountability, you're going to be involved in all types of nefarious and illegal activity because your funding is going to be derived from that. You can't get congressional appropriations for these things. And so one of the benefits of controlling the drug trade or controlling banking is you can get all types of off-the-book operations. As far as criminal activity, you have the what some people have unearthed the Bush family at the center of the SNL scandals of the 1980s and early 90s, the SNL crisis. And there's a book by Peter Bruton called CIA Mafia and George Bush. And he details in excruciating detail the names, the connections, and these things, how the Bush family connect to mafiosos and some of these business, important business figures like Michener in Texas, Linder in Ohio, and how they worked with the SNL, they worked to rob the with mafioso figures to rob the SNLs. Take bad loans and raid them to fund these operations. And when the SNLs collapse, the taxpayers left holding the bag, and they're in control of the regulatory apparatus and the media, so it never gets fully recovered. And you can just, the proof is in the pudding. And I think it was it Neil Bush who ran Silverado Savings and Loan?
Yes, Bush, yeah.
That collapsed. This thing collapsed, and he walked away with almost $1 billion. Now, how is that possible?
Just high finance, buddy.
Yeah, high finance.
You're just not good managing your money. You see, these people are smart.
It's alchemy, man.
It's alchemy. They can just pull it out of thin air.
But it's going. If you wonder how it's done, it's almost like that scene in The Sopranos when in Goodfellas when the guy who runs the restaurant brings in the mafia to protect him from this other gangster, and the gangsters go in there and use the credit and just raid that, use the store, the restaurant's credit,
the business, yeah,
and just collapse it and walk away. And that's what they do with the SNLs. And
yeah,
then you can blame the vagaries of interest rates and inflation on these collapses and these things. But basically there's like rent a bank, the banks are used, and little SNLs are being operated like the Bank of Credit and Commerce International is a writ large example of this stuff, how the huge banks are used to to launder drug money for intelligence. I mean, it's funny. Look at BCCI. It's used by the CIA and KGB. You know, this Pakistani bank. And how did this Pakistani bank get so big? Well, because it got so big because there's a huge intelligence operation going on in Afghanistan at the time. Arms smuggling, Iran-Contra. All that money has to be funneled through this place. The same thing with the Nugent Hand Bank out in Australia, or the Castle Bank. Oh, these all things are always set up by these CIA figures, like Paul Helliwell, who's a CIA lawyer, who also helped establish Disneyland out in Florida, which is interesting. But, and also which connects to also Resorts International and Donald Trump.
Yeah. I actually have a funny SNL scandal story.
Mm-hmm.
Personal experience. For a while, my next door neighbor was Fife Symington, who was the governor of Arizona, I believe, mm-hmm. for a while, and he was convicted of criminal activity during the SNL crisis, so he was convicted, and then there was an appeal, and this was during the time that Clinton, the appeal was going on during the time that Clinton was president. And took that long, all the legal maneuvers mm-hmm. and things. And on his last day as president, Clinton pardoned Mark Rich and Fife Symington.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Rich, everybody could, they go, of course, this is just typical sleaze because this guy is degenerate and had given the Clintons, millions of dollars. This was just, pay for play. That's easy. But why would Clinton pardon Fife Symington, who is a conservative Republican governor, for, felonies activities like in the SNL? And so I was having dinner with him, and I said, so what happened? How did you get off, if you don't mind my asking? He goes, no, I'm happy to tell it. He goes, when I was at college at Yale, I knew Clinton. He would, kind of ran the same social circles, and he was always drunk. And we were at a party at a river, and Clinton got dead drunk and passed out and fell into the river. And I had to go in and drag him out and revive him. And so So when he pardoned me, he said, okay, we're even now, right? So, it's an absolutely true story. That's exactly what, so, I mean, you can see how presidents are being prepared. Their moral character is developed at these universities.
So yes.
Later on, you know.
But, well, they're spotted, and their character is assessed, and they think, this is a guy we can work with.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing.
And, promote, you know, this man, yeah.
I just, like, I hate to keep doing this because I know it drives a lot of our listeners crazy, but I also just wanted to throw in one last little family detail about the Bushes, because I do think it's important, is that they're actually descended from the Fay family, and this is... you know, the they were among the Pilgrims, mm-hmm. and they weren't on the Mayflower. That this group came on the Speedwell, the other boat, but they were part of the you know, this bizarre Puritan religious group. And James Smith Bush, you know, was like great grandson of this guy, and he was an Episcopal priest. There's a lot of these, you know, I would say asterisk Christians, you know, mm-hmm. in the family. And he wrote a book that I read called More Words About the Bible, which is not too fire and brimstone, but really goes into what a wonderful thing, you know, the he focuses kind of like a pre-Scofield Bible on. In his book, he talks about how wonderful the Old Testament is. And how wonderful and how strange it is that Jews have a hard time in the Christian world, because, you know, this is really what the, mm-hmm. you know, how the Bible should be read, you know, is in this way. So it's just, it's not too clear in the book, but it does come across time to time. There's this bias, you know, that you see a lot of this in the Puritans of the Old Testament rather than the New Testament is sort of like, well, this is where kind of religious authority is. So. It kind of deserves to be explored, because then so many of these guys then end up in, you know, secret societies. You know, you've got the Boston Brahmins, you know, that pop up very quickly. You know, they're related. A lot of these guys are related back to the Puritans, and then, you know, the Tea Party, the Revolutionary War, Skull and Bones, and then here we are, Tim. We're staring at history from the outside looking in. See, all these secret societies, you know, these little closed-off religious groups that have kept some sort of secret, but somehow are able to organize themselves. Isn't it incredible? You know, we looking at, you know, Samuel Bush, and then, you know, the relationship between him and going into his other family in Prescott, then suddenly right here you go, well, wait a second, they're in charge of the munitions. They're in charge of the CIA. Mm-hmm. They all have these secret societies. You know, every generation seems to have Wolfhead Society, Skull and Bones, the Puritans. What is the secret, Tim? Well, I mean, you know, for one thing, it sure makes them rich. You know?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious explanation.
What's going on here? Tell us. What do you think is in back of the Bush family?
Well, without getting, I mean, you don't get esoteric, and there could be an esoteric element to this. This is how you game the system. How you control information. Your best way to rob a bank is to own a bank. So you own a bank, and then you control the regulatory process, so there's no investigation. Or if there is, it's shut down. And this there's the process called the 2%ers, how the people who run the bank are hired by the big boys, and they get 2% of the take. So, you know, they get the billions are lost, they get hundreds of millions. And that's how it's done. That's how, you know, people like the Charles Keating and these characters. But at the same time, it's the CIA, it's the agencies and the organized crime who are operating for bigger interests. There's a big level going on here. And so that's how it's working. And obviously, the secret society approach is how one would establish these connections and networking. And you fan out, you infiltrate the educational institutions, the media, and that's how you can control public perception. And you endow universities, and you grant degrees, you create Rhodes scholarships, right? Everything that we aspire to, everything we admire, is controlled. So.
Okay, so there's like the model could be that, I mean, basically with the Bush family, you got Samuel P. Bush, right? Mm-hmm. He's like 1863, dies in 1948. he's the guy that plugs in to the the powerful families. He becomes, obviously, he works with and for the Rockefellers. He becomes a business partner or business associate of the Harrimans, and then Bernard Baruch actually asked him to be on the War Industry Board. So this is a guy who is a meteoric rise, Tim. I mean, this seems weird to me. This seems like Martin Luther King or something. Mm-hmm. How he goes up so quickly, and then of course his family and all sides of them are Yale, and there's the secret societies. I mean, I honestly think that even if you just put aside all of the schematic that we've kind of built out over the last year, you have to admit that there is something weird here. There's something that needs an explanation, because you talk about gaming the system. Okay, they're gaming the system, but the question is, how do they do it? You know, there are a lot of ambitious people that want to get to these positions of power, but it always seems to be the same group that ends up running everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't exactly know what is at the center of it, but I think it all goes back to, ultimately, it goes back to the secret societies that network into some sort of bloodline situation, you know.
Because, yeah, that's what it looks like to me.
Because that's the ultimate way to organize a multi-generational criminal enterprise is through bloodlines. You intermarry, and that's what, you know, a lot of the royal, in the British royal family.
So, you know, the lesson for the everyday guy is that you need to find a way to get marry. Don't bother trying to work or do anything. Just find a way to marry someone who actually has a connection into this world. But you'll never make it, because they carefully monitor all that. You know, they have to have some way of quality control. And if you you come in from the outside. That's one. It's very interesting. And again, you know, it goes back to the point I've been making 100 times, is we got to get DNA on all of these guys. We need a DNA database so we can actually see the relationship between the Bush family and the Harrimans and the Rockefellers. And, just the little circle of individuals that are around the Bush family, you know, which would be the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, Bernard Baruch, the CIA guys that George W. Sr. works with. What is their relationship? You know, how does this function that these guys can, you know, if you look at how, I mean, for example, how did George Bush Sr. become head of the CIA? What were his qualifications? I mean, all he'd ever done was get shot down as a pilot, you know? And then suddenly the next thing you know, he's head of the CIA, for heaven's sakes. This is just, it doesn't make any sense. What is it that these guys have that makes it, and so that's why, you know, you, when you look at this, you go, well, you have to look inside the secret society. I know that, you know, it probably grates on people to just constantly be forced back into this, but I just think that there's just no way that anyone can really understand America if you don't actually bother to look inside this thing, you know?
Yeah, because we're not a democracy or a republic. We're an oligarchy. We're not a meritocracy, right? But you talk about crime, and, you know, people's perception. I think that the public perception of the Bush family, again, what I alluded to at the beginning, was sort of this political family, multi-generational political family. Most people's consciousness begin with George H.W. Bush, because he ran for president in 1980, lost, and miraculously was chosen by Ronald Reagan to be the vice president. And what really happened was the Bush campaign took over the Reagan White House, because they brought in Jim Baker, and Bill Casey came from the Bush campaign. They were, I think, the campaign manager and the chairman of the campaign, respectively. And it was Bill Casey who set up the Enterprise, this off the shelf operation that became Iran-Contra and these things, and almost brought down the Reagan presidency. in the 80s, was exposed in the mid 80s. People don't understand, when we talk about the Bush crime family, what are you saying they're doing? Because they think Bush, George H.W. Bush, is sort of this preppy, you know, moderate Republican, you know, and George H.W. Bush is sort of this more of a Texan, cowboy-type politician, these things, and they don't really see the crime. And I'm not getting the politics with wars and these things. I'm talking about real crime, like drug running, right? but, of course, if you're involved with the CIA and you're involved in intelligence operation, you're involved in the narcotics trafficking, because these fund these off-the-books operations. And if you look at the Bush career, whether it was Zapata Offshore Oil, or Abusto Energy, Harkin Energy, Spectrum 7. These companies, if you study them, they make no sense from a business standpoint. They never made any money, yet the Bushes made millions off them, because they're shell operations for intelligence operations, for criminal activity.
And yeah, they're making like, money. They're the Amazon of their era.
Yeah, and once someone like George Bush, H.W. Bush, has political power with the CIA or being vice president and these things, they're a political family, then that he can set his sons up for a political career, because then they can get favors and these things, because the people will give them money, write millions-dollar checks, and not care if they lose the money, because there's always someone else's money they're giving to them anyway. They'll get it back in some sort of favor later on. That's how these arrangements are made. Good example is how they gave the Texas Rangers to George W. Bush. You know, apparently he became like majority stock owner, but not putting any money into it, and this became a political move, because once he became the head of the Texas Rangers, he was on TV a lot. And of course, once you're a sports guy, and sports is very important, these political families like the Murchisons or the Bushes always want to own sports teams, because it's very important for American culture. You get notoriety, and it buys you some meritorious success, because if your team wins a pennant or a division, or you have some players, people think you're a successful businessman. In the meantime, you're just sucking off the taxpayer. Because in the meantime, the taxpayers are building new stadiums for the Bushes, new stadium for the Bushes down in Texas. That's scam. What I'm getting at is that one character really exposes the Bushes for what they are is the Barry Seal. Barry Seal, the drug smuggler, CIA asset drug smuggler. And I'm reading Daniel Hopsicker's book, Barry and the Boys, the CIA, the Mob, and America's Secret History. And this is chapter 27, The War of 1982. And I'll just read from it. And this kind of shows you just how close the war for actual crime. The War of 1982. The most talked about event in Barry Seal's much talked about life concerns the persistent rumor around since shortly after his assassination that he had been murdered when he threatened to make use of a videotape of a DEA cocaine sting which had netted George Bush's two sons, Jeb and George W. Rumors are just that, rumors. Still, when something has been whispered about for so long as this has, its very persistence becomes a story in itself, and this is the one has all the makings of a major box office thriller. Governor and presidential contender George W. Bush and his brother Florida's Governor Jeb Bush allegedly caught on videotape in 1985 picking up kilos of cocaine at a Florida airport in a DEA sting set up by the vengeful Barry Seal. Seal was said to have been angry over what he considered Vice President George Bush's shabby treatment of him. In the deal the two had cut, Seal felt Bush was to take care of his, Seal's, legal difficulties in exchange. Seal had gone to work for Bush and North at Mena, Arkansas. Now, he felt double-crossed by Bush, so the story goes his reaction had been to use DEA cover to set up a sting that ended up netting his two red-faced Bush boys. Seal then stepped in and took care of things. The Bushies were now supposedly in his debt. Plus, he hung on to the videotape shot of the sting sting for insurance. In retaliation, Seal was very publicly executed for his impudence. Less than a year later, when caught, members of his hit team all tell their lawyers that once they got to the U.S., their actions had been directed by a military officer who they were very quickly figured out to be National Security Council staffer Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. Where are the tapes? What evidence was there of the story? The evidence, that if it existed, would have been in the three boxes of documents, audio and videotape, that Seal had his employees move with him wherever he went, and they were confiscated by the FBI special agent in charge of the Baton Rouge office, who showed up on the scene less than 10 minutes after Seal's slaying. Whatever Seal was carrying around with him when he died was so hot that that to get it, the FBI broke the law and violated both the rules of evidence and the U.S. Constitution in their haste to recover Seal's files. Why was this why Barry Seal died? Our investigation into persistent reports there exists in an incriminating videotape of Republican George W. Bush caught in an aborted by Seal DA cocaine sting was unable to turn up anything to prove the allegation. But the search did uncover what was almost equally shocking. We discovered first that the plane from Seal's smuggling fleet, suspected of being flown in the alleged incident, had somehow, after Seal's death, ended up in the possession of the person who had supposedly been caught flying it in 1985, George W. Bush. It was his favorite plane. Small world, or just a coincidence? We know what Bogey would have said. Of all the planes in the world, he had to fly in mine. Even a even a bigger shock waited. The FAA apparently records records of the turboprop King Air 200 was part of Barry Seal's smuggling fleet of aircraft, which was supposedly caught on tape in the sting, led directly to some of the major perpetrators of the financial frauds of the 1980s, Iran-Contra and the savings and loan scandal. Intrigue swirled around the successive owners of this particular Beach King Air 200, intrigue of a characteristically spooky kind. The plane and the plane in just 5 years between Seal and the state of Texas motor pool, where it was Bush's favorite, had been involved in with owners who found it necessary to make the papers on a regular, unflattering basis. The intrigue includes Greek shippers paying bribes to obtain loans from American companies which should never be repaid, an American executive snatching the charred remains of a payoff check from an ashtray in an Athens restaurant, Swiss police finding bank accounts used for kickbacks and bribes, and trying to explain to ourselves how this plane went from being part of Barry Seal's smuggling fleet to becoming, according to Texas officials, a favorite airplane of Governor George W. Bush, we had stumbled onto hard documentary evidence of Barry Seal's CIA involvement. It was a major find. The FAA records confirmed that Seal, with whom the CIA has consistently denied any relationship, piloted and controlled airplanes owned by the same Phoenix, Arizona company, Grecus, which owned the major majority interest in CIA proprietary airline Southern Air Transport. Barry had a lot more to do with Southern Air Transport than has ever come out, we are told by numerous sources. Thanks to trying to track down an unsubstantiated rumor about those wastrel Bush boys, we had clear evidentiary proof that the biggest drug smuggler in American history flew CIA planes. And it connects right back to the Bushes, of course. So I thought that was sorry for the long.
No, it's really good information.
Yeah, but really that, information. That type of evidence is kind of like, do you believe in a coincidence? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I think that the evidence linking the plane to the CIA, to drug smuggling, and to the Bush family is pretty much ironclad. I think it's unlikely, in my opinion, that there's actually a videotape of the Bush brothers, handling cocaine, because I just don't think these guys operate like that. I don't think they would need to be in the weeds in this way. And I'm sure they would, they would resist it. But that story is actually how the expression the Bush crime family came into existence. Mm-hmm. They're sort of reported connection into cocaine smuggling, and this the same thing with that was later accused against Clinton.
Of course, the MENA operation is they're working with Bill Clinton.
Yeah, and so I think that
a Democrat,
right? Which I actually have a different take on it. I don't think that. They are criminals of the low crime. We did that show on high crime and low crime. I don't think they do low crime. And I think that the idea of thinking of the Bush family as a crime family is takes you to the right place rationally. I think these guys are, inside the world of the power. And so there are no laws. What people have to recognize is that the Bush family is not a crime family per se, but they are part of the great crime of having all of the world's power, the financial and political media power, outside of any kind of democratic control. Mm-hmm. That's the real crime, and so the idea of the Bush brothers are you know, they're criminal. Like, I mean, I noticed that quite a few of the nannies that the Bush family has seem to die under mysterious circumstances, you know. So,
well, was running by a car in the driveway or something?
Yeah, something like that, you know, like fall down a manhole. And now, so maybe that's kind of a low crime, you know, aspect. They have to get rid of people that learn too much inadvertently, you know. I mean, I could imagine that. But as far as handling cocaine, yeah, I don't think these guys would do stuff like that. And I think that it just takes you away from the right question, you know, which isn't, are they low criminals? These are high criminals, you know. So this, their whole thing is a high criminal. I always thought that a better kind of portal to get into thinking about the Bush as criminals, because it leads to a sort of the right understanding of the family, it's not the cocaine stuff, but it's the union banking. You know, because with Prescott Bush, because Prescott Bush, you know, when they created, well, he became a partner in Brown Brothers Harriman.
Yeah. Well, what is the union banking scandal? Tell us about that whole thing, that the whole, you know, unfortunate, you know, unpleasant event we call World War II.
Right. That little hiccup. Well, I mean, what it shows, of course, is that there is coordination between both sides of the so-called dialectic, right? The idea that the Nazi Party are somehow distinct from the ruling power, you know, in the so-called Allies is not correct. Mm-hmm. They created, you know, and you have to kind of piece it together. We've talked a little bit about in other shows, but the main thing is that Brown Brothers Harriman was basically a cutout. It was created specifically to be able to move money into Germany so that they could, you know, fund the Nazi Party, basically.
They went to Germany in the 1920s and set up branch offices, right?
Exactly right. Yeah. Then you look at, well, who are these guys? You know, well, the Brown side of Brown Brothers Harriman is the Montague Norman, the Theosoph. I cannot pronounce the word.
Theophilus.
He's working with Helen Blavatsky to develop the Nazi Party on that side of the pond, right? And so he owns it's his family, you know, investment banking company, Brown Brothers, and it's merged with Harriman. And the reason they do that is because Montague Norman doesn't want a British company or even a family company that's going to be handling the transactions. He wants to. That's why I say it's a cutout. It's created to create a partition, right? And so you have then this new legal entity, Brown Brothers Harriman, which is different than Brown Brothers, but it's staffed by pretty much a straight skull and bone secret society lineup. Even if you go to Wikipedia, which is not accurate, but they have quite a few of them. I think they list about half of them. But they don't understand that half of the other ones are actually come from families that are skull and bone families, even though the current members are not, you know, didn't go to skull and bones, but their brother did or their mother's father did or things like that. So the whole thing pretty much is a skull and bone operation. Mm-hmm. And this was set up by Montague Norman to be the funding source. So I think you can see that all of the people brought into this thing were obviously reliable. So there is a understanding in skull and bones. There is an that is shared with the Central Bank of England, right? That has to do with the creation of the Nazi Party, right? Which is something that the public, we don't get to know about, because they then funds this thing called Union Bank, right? This was Bush is one of the founding members and one of the directors of, and incidentally, one of the other directors is bloody Averill Harriman, right? So these guys
who owns like 98% of the stock or something,
yeah, right. So in other words, so this is a skull and bones owned bank, and what does it do? Well, basically, it's a clearinghouse for moving money from German industry, right, into the West to buy parts with, to buy steel with, to buy, you know, the stuff of warfare, right? Think about, we're going back now a couple generations, aren't we, into the munitions. Remember when Sam Bush was running munitions? Well, suddenly you get to see once again the merchant of bloody death, the Bush families. They're in motion once again, right? And here you've got they work with Fritz Thyssen, right? Mm-hmm. And so the money is actually the way it works is they create credit if they need be, and then they handle the transactions of moving U.S. resources, either money or our raw goods, or even sometimes finished goods, over to Germany, the stuff that Thyssen's needs. Montague Norman is his relationship is with the other financier, which is just straight credit. This is at the level of the Federal Bank, where he works with Schacht, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't work so much with Thyssen. So, but it all works out to this one big system of these groups that are in secret, that have some kind of understanding, that are basically building up the war capacity of the Nazi Party.
Yeah, and you have the Jewish banking family, the Warburgs, who are behind IG Farben.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, when you say Warburg, remember, they are just, you know, one of the inbred cutouts of the Rothschilds.
Yeah.
You have to always remember that the Rothschilds lived with the Schiff. Right. The Schiff family was lived with the Rothschilds in the same house, same compound. They were inbreeding for generations. And the other family they brought in was the Warburgs. So, you know, you can say Schiff, for example, when you talk about the founding of the NAACP. You can talk about Warburg when you talk about keeping IG Farben going, you know, during World War II. But you're just talking about the Rothschild family.
Yeah. And I think it was Victor Rothschild, who was head of British intelligence during the war, who subsequently been exposed as a communist agent. But of course, I don't think communists are agents of him. I mean, that's obviously
exactly.
It's more dialectic there going on.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. He's a communist agent because he has communications with them and seems to be in a position of authority. It's the other way around.
Yeah,
they're his agents. The whole thing is his agents. You know, so it's, you know, you're dealing with, you know, when you look at this, this is the high crime, Tim. My opinion. This is the high crime, and it's really clear, you know, with the union banking construction, because you start out with Montague Norman. He brings Brown Brothers into play. They merge it with Harriman's Bank to create a brand new entity, something that this all new virgin white thing. It then they work together to create the Union Banking Corporation. And now suddenly, Fritz Thyssen can like get all the money and all the parts and all of the stuff he needs to start to build up the war party. But what holds it all together, Tim? You know, what is holding all of these parts together? Because there does seem to be some kind of unifying principle here that enables them. The secrecy of Skull and Bones is used by the secrecy of Montague Norman, which is used by the secrecy of Fritz Thyssen, right? Everyone is being can somehow function inside of these secret societies that are related and working among them, you know, one to the other. And the public never gets a shot at it. We don't understand what's going on. We just see the war break out and everybody gets slaughtered.
Yep, yep. And they reap the profits, and they're there. And that's like, you know, this is this high level crime, which
high crime
we see it, which most Americans read as history. You know, yep. It's just history unfolding. It's governmental policy. It's the Cold War of these things. It's civil wars. It's revolutions and these things. And, you know, obviously these things, you know, these intelligence agencies are there to foment these situations, create the very situations that they're supposed to, they're to combat, like the communists in the Cold War. There's a couple of events in U.S. history when we're talking about these things about the Bush family, and some of these things may seem a bit opaque or confusing or murky to a lot of people, but there's some facts that we can point out regarding the Bushes that really betray the lie of the Bush family, of what, you know, at least how the mainstream media or standard history treats them. Regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy, how people have traced George Bush to being down there in Texas, Dallas, the night before. Then he inexplicably doesn't remember where he was when Kennedy was assassinated, despite the fact I think he was a 39, 40-year-old candidate for U.S. Senate running in against Lloyd, I think Lloyd Benston, in Texas, who ended up being a partner of George Bush, by the way. That's a whole other thing. Also involved in all the savings and loan scandals, and made a lot of money off that. He doesn't remember where he was, and of course, there's some photographs for him, perhaps him being in the Dow Tex building. That's very controversial.
But yeah, I've seen those pictures. It sure looks like him.
It looks like him. But the one thing we do know was he was very good friends with a character, with a guy named George Domorinchil, white Russian emigre who was involved in the oil industry, he was a geologist or something, but he was also an intelligence operator. He used to brief the CIA about things going on in the Caribbean. There's a book, I think, by Joanne Mellon called Our Man in Haiti. So he was very connected to intelligence operations, but he was, I guess, in his late 40s at the time, perhaps 50, middle-aged. A very refined, wealthy man at the time, I believe. Yet he was squiring around. He was sort of minding, and this isn't disputed, Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of John F. Kennedy, the 23-24-year-old, high school dropout, Marine, ex-Marine, who had become a communist and went to the Soviet Union, met his bride, and was able to come back. unbothered by U.S. intelligence or military, so we have the story of George Morenshield, who's hanging for about 6 months, getting places for the Oswalds to rent, taking Lee Harvey Oswald to the dentist and these things, providing all types of assistance up until the end of the summer of 1963. Then he kind of breaks off, and the Paines take over, who have connections to Alan Dulles, which is interesting. So, but George Morenshield, George Morenshiel was good friends with the Bouvier family. In fact, Jackie Bouvier, Jackie Kennedy, as a child, sat on his lap. So he's good friend. He knows well the assassin, according to the official narrative, of John F. Kennedy. Yet he knows both George H.W. Bush and the Bouvier family. And this is proven in a letter that George Morenshiel wrote in 1976, pleading for help from George W. Bush, then director of Central Intelligence, about he wrote a very mysterious letter saying how the ring is closing in on him. Maybe I've talked too much about the Bay of Pigs thing, which is really the Kennedy assassination. Then this is around the time of the House subcommittee hearings on the assassinations, when a lot of people are committing suicide or dying. Johnny Roselli ends up floating, cut up to pieces in Miami. Sam Giancana gets shot in the mouth. These things. And also George Domorinchil commits suicide. So what we're saying is we have the connection. George Domorinchil knows, apparently good friends with Lee Harvey Oswald, allegedly the assassin of John F. Kennedy. And he also knows who's also good friends with the Bouvier family. So how do you take those facts and reconcile it with the official narrative?
The whole thing is ridiculous. It's obviously, that it's a cluster of evil, that swirled around Kennedy and swirled around, every kind of non-controlled politician. And, that you have to always be basically, suspecting them of malfeasance.
The only answer that provides is, the only real answer we know is that the official narrative is BS.
It's just ridiculous. And, the thing is that another way you can see high crimes is not just, with the Kennedy assassination, at least you had an actual crime, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's there it is. But with high crimes, it's a lot more subtle, because sometimes it's the fact that they are involved with something reveals that there is an operation in back of some kind of social structure. Yeah. And I just wanted to point out that Prescott Bush, right, was one of the creators of what was called the American Birth Control League.
Yes, yeah.
Right. And then he, when that kind of became merged with Planned Parenthood, he actually was the treasurer of Planned Parenthood in 1947. Did you know that?
Yeah, that was, I think, he's called Rubbers Bush, because he was such an advocate of contraception.
So you could see, but you see the fact that once you identify these guys, like the Bush family, as being completely malevolent, then when you see their engagement in a social, structure like Planned Parenthood, now it's time to go back and look at Planned Parenthood, you know, and look at its relationship to the Eugenic Society and to think, well, you know, maybe this is actually basically genocide and not some kind of, you know, better functioning family.
I mean, there's different wars through demographic warfare. That's gradual depopulation through through finance, because you can crash economies and make life miserable and cause people, social engineering or social alchemy through the foundations, through the entertainment media. And we've talked about music and the culture and these things. And that's one of these high crimes, who through control of finance and information, you can wage psychological warfare on the masses and harm them through various levels of or gradations of mind controls or psychological warfare. That's what that birth control, Planned Parenthood, and the whole push that he in the middle half of the 20th century, particularly, you know, we've talked about through integration. Oh, why would these foundations support racial integration? Because you could break up the suspect Catholic or ethnic neighborhoods, and therefore continue with your American century agenda and the cultural agenda, which is depopulation and cultural degradation.
Also, it creates easy to control slaves on one hand, but on the other, it's a way to destroy a race.
Yes.
I mean, how do you actually, if you're sitting there in your little malevolent circle, you know, skull and bones, and you're trying to go, well, how do we destroy this race? You know, how do we get rid of the Poles? I don't like them. The Germans, I hate the Germans.
Yeah.
The Italians, you know, and what about these Anglos? You know, I just dislike any of... How, when you sit there in your little room, you know, with the malt scotch and the cigars and your brothers all around you, and you go, well, how the hell are we going to do this? I mean, this is one of the things that would come up, you know?
Yeah, you. I mean, obviously through integration and diversity, instead of having a tapestry of diverse people, you have a for lack of a better word, a mongrelized, weakened mass that have no identity to combat your psychological warfare. That's what Caligari called it. Those are his words.
Yeah. Obvious now? I mean, on one hand, you have a collection of very powerful and strong ethnicities, and on the other hand, you have a class of slaves.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because, you know, it's funny, like, I get correspondence from people and they say, well, you know, I just kind of agree with you, but I just feel helpless because I don't really know where to turn. And these are individuals that in another era would have known exactly who to turn to.
Yeah, they'd be at a meeting at their local parish.
Exactly. You know, you see, there'd be some kind of ethnic... relationship
or an organizational structure.
Yeah.
You know, and I give that example of Martin Mullen coming from an ethnic neighborhood in an Irish Catholic neighborhood in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, and he was the state representative there, but he controlled the purse strings. And just because he identified as an Irish Catholic from a strictly Irish Catholic district, he held up the birth control agenda in Pennsylvania for several years. And as soon as those neighborhoods were destroyed, he lost his seat. There was no, and that opposition was dispersed to the suburbs and lost their identity, and then the agenda was put forth, you know. And that's an example of the importance of that identity, you know.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a thousand, you know,
examples
of that, you know. It just happens over and over again. And so, you know, not hating on other races, but you have to separate in your mind the altruism and the alchemy of integration from the intent that the oligarchs have for it. You have to see where they're trying to take us. And you know, it's like with Martin Luther King, we talked about mm-hmm. last week. You know, when you look at him as kind of a religious figure, it makes cold-blooded analysis of what actually is supporting him a little difficult, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm. And another crime, again, when we point out some of we mention these things, people find it hard to believe that the Bush family can be involved in some of these things, is the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan in 1981, John Hinckley. Hughes happened to be the son of a business partner of George H.W. Bush, the vice president. In fact, his brother, John Lee's brother, was scheduled to have dinner the next night with Neil Bush. And this is covered one time. I think
I've heard this. Have you been able to verify
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's verified. It was reported by John Chancellor, and the Houston Post covered it one time.
And it's incredible.
and another thing is, John Hinckley's father was the head of World Vision, which connects to Mark David Chapman, who was the alleged assassin of John Lennon.
What a small world.
And this is the CIA. And this, again, World Vision is a CIA operation operating as a missionary in these things and going into these disrupted third world countries and that have been disrupted by intelligence operations and civil wars, acting as a refugee relief operation, a Christian refugee relief operation, identifying these people who will be useful intelligence assets in future years, perhaps. But these are, how do you look at that and go, oh, nothing to see here, move along? Yet people do that. I point that out to them. What are you saying? That Bush had a role in Reagan's assassination? And says, well, he did stand to benefit, didn't he? And maybe killing Reagan wasn't the objective. Maybe just sending a message. Because if you look at how Bush got on a ticket at the Republican National Convention in 1980, apparently he got a phone call from Kissinger saying, you better put Bush on your ticket or else. Because Reagan himself, although Reagan had his own backers in Hollywood, he was, when he was campaigning 80, he actually campaigned against the Trilateral Commission.
And well, I actually have a little show and tell, Tim, about how the Bush crime family affects me personally. And it affected me last night and almost led to an altercation. Can you believe that?
What happened?
Okay, well, let me tell you the story.
Did George Bush try to run you over in his wheelchair? No.
And he was carrying a copy of Catcher in the Rye.
He didn't try to fill you up, did he? No,
anyway. Well, they always do that. But, the thing is, so I went to this event, and the speaker was incredibly courageous. It was about sort of like it was on a spiritual, it was basically kind of the topic was are drugs, psychedelic drugs, kind of a good way to go down a spiritual path. Mm-hmm. And the speaker had was a divinity student guy, and he had a lot of background, very, very scholarly guy. And he was making these very kind of interesting points about it. And it seemed, like I was kind of interested in because obviously, my perspective on psychedelic drugs, this is a government op. Mm-hmm. I had spoken with this guy before the venue, and he said, yeah, that's going on there, but he says there's also some positive things, but he doesn't deny the op. And so he gets into the meeting and into the thing, and a lot of people, it's Santa Barbara, we're kind of a drug culture.
Yeah.
It's like, like about halfway through the things, he goes, yeah, and I knew Jerry Garcia, and at one point, Garcia turned to me and he said, I'm going to quit the band because I'm just tired of being in a CIA operation. I mean, he actually made – this is what the speaker said. And, of course, the crowd gasped. But then – this is the point, is the speaker then goes on. So he sets a tone of, far more kind of open to conspiratorial ideas than a lot of people were anticipating. But then he goes in, and he starts talking about how – post 9/11, and he says, whatever you believe about it, and he starts talking about it as a false flag. This is like, in a public setting, public venue, mm-hmm. There's the people there. And no one kind of, is upset about this. There's no gasping like there was when he mentioned that Jerry Garcia said he was like in a CIA. But when he talked about 9/11 as an inside job, everyone just kind of, you could see that it was almost like, kind of understood. Well, anyway, so the event ends and I start to walk out and this guy comes up to me and he gets pretty aggressive and he's saying, so you agree with the speaker, don't you, that 9/11 was an inside job? And I go, yeah, I certainly do. I go, the building falls straight down and the BBC announcer, she's talking about it collapse before it fell down. So it's obviously not. Well, the guy went ballistic on me. I mean, really got crazy. And he starts screaming that the BBC announcer has been debunked. It's been debunked, you know, and he takes his hands and he starts spinning it next to his ear faster and faster. He goes, you've got to start thinking. You've got to start thinking. And he's spinning his little hand next to his ear like it's like a egg beater. And I say, well, actually, you know, she says that the building falls down and the video shows the building still standing running yeah. back. How can you debunk that? What is to debunk? And at this point, he got kind of aggressive. And I thought we might actually get into a fist fight. And, you know, you got to like, remember, I'm like this big guy, you know, and like, you really have to want it if you're going to try to fight me. And I thought, man, it looks to me like he's getting pretty close to it. And I said, okay, well, I just said, you know, we'll discuss this some other time. And, my wife was right next to me. And so we walked away, you know.
Was this the guy from Snopes?
No. No. It's someone that just is a person who knows my political position and was triggered by the idea of someone in public setting having the temerity to actually mention the possibility of 911 being an inside job. And then when he came up to me and tried to browbeat me and you know, the opposite happens where I just, you know, point out that he's being ridiculous. But then that triggered him and he just went kind of crazy. And so I got in the car with my wife and I go, you know, that darn Bush crime family.
Well, I mean, you mentioned 911. I think we'd be remiss tonight if we didn't mention the Bush's connection to the Bin Laden family and how they play the Bin Laden family through the Bin Mahfouz family, this banking family. Of course, the Bin Laden family itself made a lot of money off building infrastructure and bases. I guess they're making money off the military industrial complex as well. But the Bin Laden family and the Bush family were business partners through the Carlyle Group. And
I have a question. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I mean, I just have a question. The World Trade Center wasn't Jeb Bush or not Jeb Bush, but the other brother.
Wart.
Wasn't he a director of the security company?
Yeah,
or something?
I think it was Wart Walker.
Yeah.
Walker, I think. A cousin was the security firm there.
I mean, aren't there some other family in the world than the Bush family? I mean, how can this be? It's just crazy to me that you know, everywhere you look, there they are. You know, and whenever there's explosions, you've got the Bush family right there next to it. You know,
yeah, and I mean, that's just again, we get the Bush family. You see the illustration of how these families, through their connections through finance, banking, intelligence, these things, are able to make so much money off the misery of the world. I think it was Harkin Energy. I mean, this really gets in the murky stuff. Was financed by the Harvard Trust. The guy who ran Harvard Trust is a guy named Stone, who traces back to MacArthur during the Second World War, and MacArthur's war with the OSS over the Japanese gold, the so-called Yamashita's gold that Sterling Seagraves writes about in his book, and. The Philippines itself, and this gets into the dealings with Marcos in the 70s and 80s, and all this weird funding. Again, what this gold is represented was a huge, huge slush fund financing for off-the-book operations. Same thing with the Nazi gold and these things. And it turns out when wars are fought, the people, the governments that are waging war for the interests that are really waging the wars, they steal the gold. And for the time being, the Japanese and the Germans stole the gold. And when the Japanese and Germans were defeated, well, the OSS stepped in. And there was this struggle for gold and control of the gold in the Philippines. And this brings in, connects to Ed Lansdale, the stuff in the Philippines and the Yamashita's gold. Apparently, the Bushes themselves were getting their beaks wet a little bit with some of the stolen loot from World War II.
Well, remember that, you know, it's like small world, but in the Union banking situation in World War II, that Union Bank was actually accused in 1942 of holding the gold for the Nazi leaders as collateral. Did you know that they were actually directly accused? Now, they were able to get out of it, but investigations at that time were saying, wait a second, it looks like the Nazis moved the gold to the Union Banking Corporation, where the Union Banking Corporation was then using it as collateral, you know, as it was, you know, basically giving war goods to the Nazis before the war began.
Oh, yeah. The blind trust that George Bush put his estate in when he became vice president, the guy who did that, was it Ferris? I forget his name. He has ties back to some of that, and also making money off the Auschwitz industrial project. You know, the slave labor and these things. That Standard Oil and AT&T were involved in, IBM, I'd rather, were involved in that. And you know, the standard line, you know, is that these companies were doing business with the Nazis. They just didn't care. And, you know, so the indictment is you're doing business with the Nazis, but it's, as you and I both know, it's much more complicated than that, because the Nazis themselves were set up, you know, to do what they were doing.
And this goes to the fact that one of the really high crimes, is the idea that, or the fact that our financial system is completely fake, you know, that basically, there's ledger main, which is to say, just made up numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about a plunge protection team that exists somewhere in Washington to keep the stock market, you know, in operation. That there's a secret slush funds of money. You know, I don't think that that's the case. I think that they just control the computer, and that they just put out any number that they think is a number that should exist. And I'll point a couple things out. One is that when the crash occurred in 08, the S&P bottomed at 666. It's called the devil's bottom. Now, the other thing is that you had the flash crash, you know, which they said was, well, it was actually a 1,000-point round trip, 1,000-point drop in like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't 1,000. It was 999. It was 999, which is 666 just upside down. And so my point is that that should show you that if these numbers are just fake, they were just put there, you know, for the amusement. Man, all the numbers are fake. It's like, you really think that Apple is, you know, or Amazon is worth, you know, $400 a share. I mean, these are just the numbers that...
They've never registered a profit.
Of course not, but see, I don't think there's ever anyone who ever, you know, who has any kind of real financial power who's ever bought any of the stock. It's just a few little peons that come in and give them their like weekly paycheck, and then they produce these numbers because this gives a kind of certification to a corporation as being, you know, successful, and it's, you know, everything is on the up and up. And their stock is so high, and you got Tesla and all these, you know, these stocks are just rough. But the fact is, these companies are just, you know, in the structure of basically total slave system in the future, where, you know, you have cars that take you only where you know, certain people want you to go, and all commercial goods are delivered through drones, and they will give you exactly the amount of food you must take and whatever, you know. So this is the brave new world.
It's the company story we're talking about. They're trying to, and the corporations are there for social engineering. They can direct the culture, because once you're enslaved in the corporation, you have to be a good little worker bee. And they want to do it with small inside businesses where there's some degree of independence, and there's some, maybe perhaps even some competition. God forbid, competition is a sin, as John D. Rockefeller reportedly said, competition with him. And you get with these corporations, and that's the same thing. And whether it's Bain Capital or Walmart or Amazon, these things, you immediately see these intelligence. Of course, Amazon is obvious. Jeff Bezos. With Walmart, you see, and also with Tyson's Food, these huge corporate combines are growing along with the narcotics trafficking, because, you know, Arkansas and these things had a lot to do, money flowing in there. And this also coincides with something Bush was involved with too in the 1970s, because Nixon appoints some UN ambassador, then envoy to China, in the 1970s, and this coincides with the Trilateral Commission agenda and also the creation of sort of the shotgun marriage that Henry Kissinger negotiated between the Saudis, United States, with the petrodollar. This would lead to the high crime we talk about, where you don't really identify as social alchemy through high finance, the deindustrialization of the United States, and the fundamental change of U.S. culture into a debt society, a consumer-driven society, a debt society, a degraded society, exporting all that industrial capacity to China and fundamentally changing Chinese society. I don't know if they've kept it under control. Perhaps China's being – I have to imagine China has to be hard to manage. So I'm not sure to what extent China represents an opposition or represents being uncooperative or not. But you see these corporations being are working, like the Walmart thing arrangement would not have been possible without Rockefeller's China agenda. It's all based on that model. And really, did the Waltons know all this? Are they that smart? No, they were set up for this stuff. And that's another thing, is these successful families, whether it's Bill Gates or who's that other guy at Apple, Stephen Jobs or the Walton these families are like, they're like Betty Crocker and Ronald McDonald. It's branding, and we need names, but they may physically exist, but I'm saying they're put up there. Same with the nerd over there at Facebook. Did you really think that was his idea? Zuckerberg. Do you really think the social media, that narrative is true? No.
It's just preposterous. Yeah. I mean, it's the stupidest piece of software imaginable.
Yeah.
Twitter, Facebook, Amazon. These are just obvious, cutouts of the Brave New World that we're supposed to believe are like actual, marketplace products, when the fact is they are just 100%. Slave contraptions. It's just the technology they're developing to control us. That's all there is. And then with Walmart, incidentally, getting back to the good old Bush crime family, if you've ever seen the videos of the point where Walmart was going to go nationwide and they had a big party, man, they had all the Bush family guys right there.
Yeah,
on stage, they were all hugging and then of course Walmart kicks back. I don't know how much they've given. I think it's hundreds of millions of dollars, incidentally, to the Bush family. But, the thing is, it is an overall plan that the public is unaware of. In this case, it was that they were going to import Chinese goods because they were going to get rid of the manufacturing sector in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah,
and then they would have a company store, Walmart, that would be the point of vending, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then they could all invest in Walmart safely, knowing that it was going to be basically a monopoly once they got rid of all the manufacturing jobs in the U.S. And so, it's when a good investment program, one that I don't know if you ever have this discussion when people sit around. At these parties, and they asked about investments, and I always say, well, the only way to do it is just look where the oligarchs are stealing stuff, because if you can see that, if you saw the Bush family on stage with the Walmarts, I mean, they're just a little ridiculous dollar store in Arkansas, right? And then here they're going to go nationwide, and they've got funding, and they're the Bush family on stage. And then, well, that's your clue. It's the fact that you have the wired-in family, the politically wired-in family. That's what's what you need to be paying attention to.
In the geopolitical events that are leading to it to its meteoric rise. One is the Yom Kippur War and the Arab embargo, which was a setup, and the rise in oil prices, the petrodollar. Because then in the 80s, you're seeing the dirty wars in Central America and Afghanistan, the drug trade, and all that money, all that cash has got to be laundered somewhere. It's laundered through these equity funds that fund these corporations. And how? I mean, and of course, the mid-size operation, the mom and pop operation, doesn't have the benefit of Barry Seal depositing $20 million in their bank account. what Arkansas Development Finance Company agency was funded by Clinton, was to launder drug money, and then they got their
So I, there was this one little pithy story that amused me last week. I was reading it. The guy was pointing out, he goes, there's other debt on the planet.
I'm sorry. So
he goes, you look at all like the central banks.
You're breaking
up. $200 trillion. Can you hear me?
I hear you now. Go ahead. Start over again. I'm sorry.
He said, I'm sorry. He said there's $200 trillion of debt,
mm-hmm.
right, in the world. And he says I've done some calculations and I've determined that based on the the activity of all of the economics of and the activities of the nations, that the total amount of debt that can possibly be serviced is less than $30 trillion. And he goes, so where is all the money going? where is it all going? And he says there's only one possible solution to the answer to the question. He goes, the world must be an apartment complex managed by aliens. he said there's just no other way, And it was very subtle humor, because basically what the guy was saying is that that the whole economy is fake, mm-hmm. you see, that without just being able to invent stuff out of thin air, that there, that what we see as wealth and economic activity would just dissolve. And so when you look at, Walmart and Amazon and things like this, you're really just looking at fiat currency, right? That, in other words, invented money.
Yeah.
But that basic, this is one of the basic powers of the Bush families. And if you look at, look at their activities in the banking world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Munitions and banking. This is the family. But the idea that we have that the dollar is real, that these economic systems are real, this is really a terrible point of weakness, in the citizen. It's much better to realize that they're completely fake. Now, the problem is, of course, is how do you live in the world?
Yeah.
What do you do? People struggle their whole lives to get a few a few hundred thousand dollars in savings, and it doesn't matter if you believe that the dollar is fake and has no future. It's still working today.
Yeah.
And so, we live in the moment. We have to, pay attention to it, try to do our best. But at the same time, I just think those people who are looking, downstream with investments are kind of silly. And I would, and I don't know, when you think about the Bush family controlling and their group controlling all of the fiat currencies all over the place, you wonder, well, what to do? Some people say precious metal, others say cryptocurrency. The friends I have are more just, bullets and beans,
yeah.
They just want weapons and food, they don't believe in anything. It seems like I always say that is just, I don't like that position at all, because if you're at the point where you're going to go off into the woods and you'd be like these preppers, they've got these, they train in camouflage outfits, yeah. And they're learning how to live on dead squirrels, look, you're not going to like that life, and it isn't going to last 10 seconds, because if the system completely collapses, you really think you can go out into the countryside and shoot deer?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm telling you, there won't be a deer left in the 48, the state. So there's nothing to eat. You're all going to starve to. If you're at the point where you're getting a prepper outfit and learning how to use weapons and survival, forget all that. Throw that all away. Become politically active. This is what you should be doing. You should be instead of trying to just save yourself, every man for himself, try to just go the other direction. Try to create some political unity, right? Go to your prepper friends and say, let's just forget all this. Let's get out there at the farmers markets and in front of Walmart, if they'll let us, and set up coffee tables and try to show people that we have to go in a different direction as a society, as a people. And the other thing is, if beyond political activity, is try to create congregation. Try to create, go to the churches and those things which have congregation and say, look, we need to have larger brotherhood connections. All of the churches, all of the humanist societies, all of the prepper organizations, mm-hmm. all of these things should be unified. The Democratic Party got caught this week. There was a videotape of one of their guys telling some guy was going to run for office, and the guy said, look, you're not going to get funded by us. you're not inside the deal. This is how the party works. Get the hell out of here. I mean, this is actually was on tape. And it's just so basically democracy is a joke at this point. Well, that's something the public can act upon. We have to replace the Republicans and the Democrats. And you go, well, the oligarchs will just come in and run the other stuff, whatever we do. Well, let's try to stop them.
Yeah.
Let's try to expose them. What, you know, there is no purpose and no gain to just give up, right? Come on, we're in the food chain. Life is a fistfight. It's supposed to be a struggle. This is a heroic moment. This is something that should inspire, not make people depressed. Get out there and do something, right? Organize. Tell people. Don't be afraid. So that's my little speech, Tim, on you know what to do with the Bush crime family is have a political response to it.
Yeah, and a simple revolutionary act, which isn't particularly violent, and nor does it set you up to be targeted as a hater or some sort of dangerous individual like a David Koresh or a Randall Weaver. Even if you want to go off and by yourself, they won't let you be alone anyway. It's just deny the system its legitimacy. And
And live outside of it and try to organize like crazy.
As best you can. And,
best you can. Exactly. Yeah.
And don't raise consciousness about the reality of the Bush family and the powers that they serve.
And I'll just tell you my little rebellion here. Now, we're pretty well off, so we can do some stuff that most people can't do. But in our little place, we have got solar panels, right? Mm-hmm. We have got a lot of raised beds, so we grow most of our own food, right? We do that. And we drive an electric car. Now, the electric car, people wonder about this. They go, well, isn't that expensive? And, but think about it politically. I've got my solar panels, and I'm getting my backup battery. So I'm going to get completely off of the grid, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when I drive my little electric car out, I'm driving it on my energy. I'm not BP or Oriole with the Rothschilds. I mean, I'm not giving anybody any money. I know, Tim, you're probably laughing at me. You're thinking, oh, he's eccentric and he's really silly because he's not doing much. But you know something? It feels good to me to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and so, that's one less. The more food you grow yourself, the less food you spend at the national chain,
Exactly. Yeah. And the food's better for you.
Yeah. And that's, another thing is that it's much better for you. So you don't get sick. You don't get sucked into the medical industrial complex, which is owned by the oil companies anyway. So,
well, and the biggest op that's going on right now is food and vaccines. I mean, this is how they're creating the epsilons and delta class, mm-hmm. Is that the brains won't develop naturally if you just live in the toxic soup. So, What do you do? Learn about medicine. Learn about how to avoid letting them stick things in you, and don't eat any of the chemicals food that they try to give us.
So
that's how you resist the crime. See, this is how you fight back against high crime.
Yeah, because going to the barricades or going to the woods and shooting squirrels isn't going to overturn.
It's not going to do anything.
It's going to do anything.
That whole thing. It just the only act is the political act. That unifies people.
There's nothing against game hunting for food, knowing how to do that. I'm not saying that, nor knowing how to use a weapon. These are useful skills, and so. But as far as
it's not a political act. I mean, this is basically every man for himself, and just do what you have to do to survive. Well, we're not at that stage yet.
No,
and let's try to avoid that stage.
It's that atomization is what they seek.
Exactly. When you see these guys with their camouflage outfits on and black paint on their face and learning how to shoot ARs, and they've got like skinning deer and eating like roadkill, squirrels. I mean, they basically are victims. They've given up. The ability to be a real political force, a real ethnic force, they shouldn't be there eating the squirrel meat. Mm-hmm. They should be at the farmer's market or at Walmart with a coffee table, and they shouldn't be with an AR. They should just have like a very well-reasoned argument about 911 was an inside job, for example.
Yeah.
It's like my little you know, face to face last night with, a crazed,
crazed normie.
Yeah, crazed normie, right? And he was, as his finger was spinning violently, explaining that I wasn't being logical. You know, as he spinning his finger, you know, this is, you know, the way that you respond to this is with political action, and that's why, you know, it's one thing, you know, like I read the comments and I don't respond typically, you know, because one of the reasons I don't is just because I'm really hoping that. You know, to our YouTube of the film of our show, because I really hope that our audience can become a congregation. That would be the greatest thing, you know. If there's anything that I could wish for in the world, and I have a birthday coming up, Tim.
Oh, happy birthday!
This would be the gift, you know, is to have just organization, congregation, brotherhood, sisterhood that the people who listen to us would realize, you know, we have something in common.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a really important political kind of perspective, and we need to protect each other. And so the first thing we got to do is to make sure we don't lose touch and establish more and more communication, you know, help one another with homeschooling, help one another avoid vaccination. There's a lot of things we can do without basically leaving the house, you know, in terms of the, you know, virtual community,
yeah.
Principles of powers and principalities, you know, is that we have the virtual community, but there's a lot of stuff people can do just to connect with one another and then just keep it up, just keep organizing. We have to become basically a political party.
Yeah. And, you know, convinced, yeah, it, that maybe, it's not good. Maybe you shouldn't go to college, go into debt. Maybe you should have a larger family.
In these yes, things, you know. Exactly. There you go. Well, because since they're telling us to go to the Ivy League and use birth control, maybe we would go, huh? Well, let's see. these guys have my best interest at heart.
I'll go to the community college and have six kids.
Yeah, that's what you want to do, and then meet a whole bunch of people yeah. that you can get along with politically and stay in touch and keep in contact. Tim.
Yes.
I don't know what happened, but we've lost you.
No.
Anyway, I think we yep. put a good face on it, brother.
Yeah.
So thank you so much. It was a lot of fun, and I will get them next week, okay?
Okay, Joe. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you,
brother. Yeah, I pulled the plug out of my thing here, so my chair caught the cord. So, no. Okay, Joe. Talk to you next week then.
Okay, buddy. Talk to you next week. Thank you.
Take it easy. Bye bye.
Bye bye.